Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. When you think of sports and medicine, the unfortunate association nowadays is with performance-enhancing drugs. Athletes of all stripes are looking for an edge in a competitive world. But sports medicine goes well beyond the headlines. Most of us live sedentary lives, sitting at our desks, typing on our computers, which is why we need to make ourselves exercise for optimum health. Since we are no longer hunter-gatherers and our interstate highway system leads to long commuting times in automobiles, we become weekend warriors and hobbyist exercisers. In this world, we tend to see many common muscle and joint overuse syndromes, which is why an emphasis on motion and strength is a useful specialty for a healthcare provider to have. My guest today, Dr. Lamont Cavanaugh, is a family doctor who specializes in sports medicine. He is an advocate of the Exercise as Medicine program, which is a means of getting people more active for better health away from the maw of industrialized medicine that relies too frequently on elixirs and potions to substitute for doing the right thing. He and his colleagues in sports medicine serve as physicians and trainers for multiple teams here in the greater Tulsa area, in addition to running a sophisticated exercise physiology laboratory. Dr. Monty Cavanaugh is my guest today here at Studio Tulsa on Health. Dr. Monty Cavanaugh, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
I want to start by asking you about this idea of exercise as medicine. So who started that and what does it mean exactly?
Well, I think if you look back in time, you know, guys like Ken Cooper really got that concept going and really focusing on exercise. But this program, Exercise as Medicine, was developed through the American College of Sports Medicine. And it really focuses on the fact that if we look at a lot of the medical conditions that we face as physicians day in and day out, most of them have a significant benefit from exercise. And you think of all the most common things that we see, especially the ones that are in the news the most now, type 2 diabetes, the big in the news now with the obesity epidemic we have. Well, the primary thing for us to do as physicians to treat that is improve somebody's nutrition and get them to exercise, and then in turn get them to lose weight.
Okay, so say I'm an average patient, let's just assume.
Okay.
What do you tell me about exercise? Right now I don't exercise. I sit at a desk a lot of the time.
Sure.
I spend a lot of time on the computer. You know I should exercise, but I'm in the bad habit of not exercising. What's a good starting point?
Well, you know, I think one of the important things for everybody to answer is why. And everybody has a different why for what they want to do it. For a lot of people, when they get it to the mid-40s or the mid-50s, what they're looking at is they want longevity. And they start seeing that, you know what, I want to be able to exercise with my kids and my grandkids. I want to be able to go in the backyard and play and be able to do all of those things. They also start seeing that, you know, I want to be functional the older that I get. And so I always try to find out, hey, what can be the why for that individual? A lot of times when we start talking about things like they've just newly been diagnosed with diabetes, and for a lot of people, that scares them to death. And they want to know what can they do to help fight this off and then possibly not have to go on insulin. So that's a big motivator for people. So when I get those folks and we kind of find out what the why is, and then we can start working on what are some of the simple ways to just start. And for most people, a simple thing is to just find 5 minutes during the day and do something. And it may be as simple as walking. I like, for people that are really inactive, especially if they're overweight, I like getting them to walk in a pool because it takes all the stress off their joints. It's a great form of exercise, and they can do it in as little as 5 minutes. But what we try to build is we want to start doing it every day. And you get in that habit pattern, and then we slowly start increasing what they're doing every day.
And in your practice, you see folks, like you mentioned, who are newly diabetic, who aren't exercisers, and you're using the idea of exercise as a medicine, as a powerful medication to, in a sense, avoid, you know, having to take other pills or do other types of medical treatments.
Sure.
And but you're also seeing high-performance athletes, are you not?
We do. We see all levels, and we see people that will be professional athletes, professional triathletes, things like that. We do that, or the folks that are the very, very high-performing amateurs, and we see them, and we try to help them get better. They're continually wanting to improve. They want to swim faster. They want to run faster. They want to bike faster. And so we have a lab to be able to test them and be able to give them training programs to help them do that.
Can somebody exercise too much?
Yeah, absolutely. You can actually overtrain. The body is a system, and it requires rest. I mean, that's why everybody needs to sleep every night. But also we need physical rest. We need recovery. So as we're going through and we're exercising, we will stress the bodies. The muscles, the tendons, the bones, they can get micro tears that are there. And it's very important that we have enough rest in between for the body to repair itself adequately. You know, the other really important piece is you have to have adequate nutrition and proper nutrition for the body to heal itself.
Tell me about the field of sports medicine. I mean, how did it get conceptualized, or what's the formal definition of it?
That's interesting. Is there a formal definition? And most people put us in the box of, hey, you take care of guys that are girls that are on teams and athletes. And we definitely do that. And so we understand the concept of team and what participating like that in team sports. But we really focus on getting people active and helping them continue to be active. So we take care of people from very young to very old. We address all sorts of musculoskeletal problems, but also we help people to be able to continue to be active with things such as diabetes or asthma or even heart disease, anything which may be in the way of them continuing to exercise and be active. We can help them to continue to be active with that.
So what motivated you to choose sports medicine as a specialty?
You know, I liked a couple of aspects of it. I really enjoyed the musculoskeletal care. I really enjoyed taking care of athletes because, in general, athletes are really motivated. They want to get better. And so it's a group of people that strive to continue to improve themselves all the time. What I found that after I got into doing more and more, I really liked the aspect of improving health. And in sports medicine, we do a lot of that because we're about exercise, we're about good nutrition, and those are the building blocks people need to really achieve good health. And when we do that, we also see that people's livelihood is better, their well-being is better. I love hearing a patient that once we have worked with them on getting them more active, we help them through any kind of injuries they may have, we see that they've gone from somebody who really hasn't been doing much from a physical standpoint in their life to maybe now they're running marathons. And we see that transition. And the great thing is to hear them say, gosh, I feel better now than I felt in 20 years. And that's not uncommon. And it makes me feel good. I like helping people in that way.
So you must get asked a lot. I mean, are you an athlete or were you an athlete at some point?
I was one of those guys. I was never a superstar in anything, but kind of liked doing everything. I got into running when I was in college and in medical school, started running more. And I did it much more just because I knew I needed to, not because I really enjoyed it. And then when I was in the Air Force, I actually fell in love with just running because it was fun. Started doing marathons at that point and just continued doing that. And so now I know that it's good for me and I do it because of that. But also I really enjoy it and I enjoy lots of different things. So I enjoy things all the way from, playing tennis to playing golf to running long distances to riding a bike to shooting a basketball. So I like it all, which probably makes me a good sports medicine doc because I also like watching it all too. So I'm just as happy going to any type of sporting event.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Monty Cavanaugh from OU Tulsa Sports Medicine. And you mentioned that you picked up running kind of later in life, you said college, medical school, Air Force. So in marathons, how many marathons have you run now?
I think I've done 4 now and done some halves and some things like that. And it may sound like a lot, but, for the people that really do marathons, that's really not. It's amazing. There's people that'll do, 4 marathons in a year.
So is running sort of the most common athletic endeavor for the patients that you see, or is there not a particular sport or training exercise that you see most in your patients?
Well, I think running or walking, I think, is really common. And that's because it's just so easy for the most part. Really, you need a pair of shoes. And, sometimes you can get really pricey shoes, but, most people can even get pretty reasonably priced shoes. And you don't need a lot of other equipment other than that. We utilize some of the new technology and you can use GPS tracking and so give you your speed and your pace all the time. And we do some fun things with measuring someone's heart rate all the time so they can optimize their fitness level and their training. But you don't need to have that. There's some very simple things you can do with walking and running and get really good benefit out of it.
Do people primarily come to you by sort of looking up on the web or hearing programs like this and seek you out, or is it referral-based stuff mostly where a different doctor says, oh, you know, you're a runner, you got this leg thing, I've tried the kind of usual things, I'm going to send you to sports medicine now.
Usually they're referred by their providers. We get a fair number because we have a human performance lab. We get a lot of word of mouth that comes through. And so they see what we do in testing athletes. And then when they get injured, they want to come see us too, which is good. They know we really focus on runners. We are passionate about runners. And so we do a lot of training with runners. We definitely rehab a lot of runners. They like the fact that we have physical therapy in our office too. And we're very biomechanically oriented. So we've got a lot of those bells and whistle things, and which attracts people even outside of getting referrals.
So let's talk a little bit about human performance. What tools are available in the lab? And I guess for the listening audience, you know, when would I think about either wanting to send someone to it or trying it out myself?
Sure. I think everybody should try it once. You know, it's some of the stuff that you see on the TV shows where you're breathing in and out through a tube while you have them running on a treadmill or on a bicycle. And that's a VO2 max machine. And what we can do with that, and we can actually measure how much oxygen somebody is taking in and how much carbon dioxide they kick out. And then we can calculate exactly how many calories they're using during that time. Well, we can measure the efficiency of how they do that. And by doing that and coupling that with a test, just a finger stick blood test called a lactic acid, we can build nice modeling for them about how they should be training. So we can find the areas where they're really strong or really weak in their cardiovascular fitness or cardiopulmonary fitness, and we can train to that and make those areas better. So if they want to be a better longer distance runner, we can find the zones of training where they need to be trained in to maximize that. And that's what I think that's probably the most powerful thing we do. It's nice that we can do it on a treadmill and we can do it on a bike. And so that's a kind of a variety for those different folks that do it. It'd be great if we could do it for swimmers in the water. The technology is just not that great to be able to do that. But there'll be a day when we'll really have a self-contained unit where we could do that even on a swimmer really well. We also do video gait analysis, which for runners, we see a lot of folks that like that. So, you know, somebody will come in, they're just kind of hampered by maybe just a nagging type of thing. It's not something that's keeping them from running. They're still doing well, but they notice that their hamstring is tight all the time, or they're struggling with this or struggling with that. And it's amazing when we can videotape them in their shoes, we'll videotape them barefoot, and being able to slow that down and see them step by step what they're doing. We can identify some of those areas where we really can help to correct their form. And sometimes it's not even from an injury standpoint. Sometimes they just want to run better. And so we can do that, and we can make them a much more efficient runner. Because for most people that just kind of go out and really haven't studied the gait and the running gait and optimize that, they waste a lot of energy doing movements that really don't help propel them forward.
You know, it's interesting because you think about when you're a kid and you're parents or your maybe older brother or older sister teaches you how to throw a ball or how to shoot a basket, and so you may copy their form, or they might even teach you what they read in a book or something. Nobody really does teach you how to run unless you're, say, on a track team or a cross-country team. I mean, you just run in just something we all do somewhat instinctively, right, with that fight-or-flight response.
Sure.
And I guess some of us are better natural runners than others.
Absolutely. It's very true. And it's definitely is not just for the elite runner. I think runners on every level can benefit not only from the gait analysis piece. And so looking at, hey, how can I just be a more efficient runner? Because it makes it more fun. It makes it easier, which is a nice thing. Also, runners on every level can really benefit from like doing a VO2 max test, because it lets you know where you are right now. And especially if you have any kind of a goal you've set, hey, I want to run a 5K just a little bit faster than I did before. It's nice to be able to say, all right, now I've got an idea of what do I need to do to train to that to really reach my goal.
One thing I've always wondered, if you had two people of the, say, the same age and even the same size, same build, okay, even say their diet's the same and the same, relatively same level of training, like maybe they're both mild runners or run a few miles a week, and you do the VO2 testing where you get them on the treadmill and you measure their oxygen intake and carbon dioxide output. That's where the genetics comes in, right? If you control for everything else, one of them's going to be much more efficient just by virtue of sort of who their parents were than the other, perhaps. Now, the other could train, right, and overcome that sort of a genetic difference, perhaps?
Well, some of it, you know, to an extent. If it was simply training to overcome all those things, we'd all be, you know, superstars. There'd be a lot more of them because people would realize that, hey, I can just train through all of this and can get to it. But there is a level of genetics that plays a part. And with muscle composition, just how we utilize oxygen. So there's definitely a piece of that. And it's amazing when you start seeing that. You know, you see some of these people that, a VO2, my maximum oxygen utilization for my age may be, in the 40s. Well, you could take a guy like Lance Armstrong, and he'll be 75. Just incredible differences there.
So it's just that it's a percentage. So he's just using the oxygen more efficiently or burning it more effectively.
He does. He uptakes it better and utilizes it better, and then kicks off CO2 better. And some of it is training, definitely. You know, you take a guy like that, or if you take an elite level cyclist like that, a lot of that, they do really well from a training standpoint. But when you get to that level, that genetic part of just, five level difference between them can make all the difference in winning or not winning.
Huh. So you mentioned Lance Armstrong, so I guess I got to ask if you're in sports medicine. Lately, we've been reading all about Alex Rodriguez, a baseball player, but it seems like the sports page, which when I was a kid, there was none of this stuff. Almost every day now, there's an article about somebody in some sport using some banned substance to try to get an edge. And I guess one question I have is, do you see this in your practice? I mean, that's not the kind of sports medicine, obviously, you're doing. It's not like you're trying to help people, say, get off these things. Right. And I don't tend to see them in my practice because these are generally young, healthy people looking for an edge who are sort of outside the medical system or dealing with kind of sketchy parts of the medical system. So they're not the people I'm seeing in my practice. How do you interface with that? Or you're taking care of young athletes, so you got to be probably singing them the gospel of trying to stay fit, healthy, and a clean life.
Right, absolutely. And we know that it's out there. We know even in the high school level still it's out there. Fortunately, it's not super prevalent, but it's still there. And we see it in different levels, and people have different motivations for that. We see it in, unfortunately, there's a group of men in their 30s that have a tendency to use a lot of anabolic steroids because they want to get bigger. They're in the gym a lot. They want to get bigger. They're not competing for anything. They're not looking to make money, anything. It's just that persona, the image of getting bigger. Most of what's driven, banned substances in sports is money. It comes down to, hey, if I can be just a little bit faster, and if I can weigh, have 10 more pounds of muscle, then I may be able to go from playing college football to playing professional football. And that's a huge payday. It's a big difference. Even the kids in high school that go, gosh, if I can just be a little bit bigger, can I go play college football and get school paid for free? It's a big payoff. And so you see some of those things that drive that. And unfortunately, it's real and it's out there. And the more technology advances, and we see these nice medical advances all over the place, well, they also advance in these areas too. So now we're starting to battle things like, well, can you genetically manipulate people to be stronger or be faster? Those types of things. And so now you're getting some of those aspects that are higher and higher technology. They're harder and harder to catch. So it's a challenge. And as long as there's money out there where people will make millions and millions of dollars, there'll continue to be people that are trying to maximize what they do.
Well, I don't want to belabor this, but what do you think about people who say it's too hard to police? We ought to just, these are professionals, and we ought to just, they want to be the best and strongest and fastest they can be. Like, let's just no longer ban them or legalize them, I guess you could say, and let catch as catch can. I mean, do you think there's any merit to that argument, or that we might eventually head in that direction?
Gosh, I hope we don't, because the bottom line is it's dangerous. So yes, they may be able to do it. They may be able to do it for a short period of time. A lot of these things, we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be. And if you just open that system up, then what you get is you'll get people that will be using them continuously. And we really could run into some serious problems later on. It's a dangerous, dangerous proposition. And then also, I think it gives us a very poor example for kids. So what does that tell the kids, where you're willing to do anything it takes to get an edge, to get an advantage, as opposed to what your natural ability is? You're willing to do anything outside of that to get ahead.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Dr. Monty Cavanaugh, the Director of Sports Medicine at OU School of Community Medicine here in Tulsa. And we were just talking about performance-enhancing drugs in sports. Another big topic you see in the sports headlines that I think you know a fair bit about, being a team doctor for a lot of things, is concussions. And there's been a lot of coverage, I would say, in some of the national papers, USA Today or New York Times, about especially I think in football, where high impact is part of the game, and we're starting to see the delayed effects, I think, in some of the older athletes, the retired athletes, who are really having what amounts to early dementia. How have you seen this transition over the course of your career, or what kinds of requirements are you now seeing for evaluating concussions?
Well, there's been a huge transition just over my career, which is in the last 20 years. The amount of knowledge that we've gained and the amount that we still need to gain to really understand it is tremendous. It used to be that we would line kids up across from each other and they just went head-to-head and helmet-to-helmet and knocked each other until they knocked somebody down. And we're realizing that that really can damage brains. Fortunately, the awareness of this has really come to the forefront. We're getting smarter and smarter about what we need to do with it. We're realizing that there are no mild brain injuries, and there are no, hey, you just got your bell rung, get back out there and play. We're realizing that puts people in danger. We still don't understand everything we need to understand about the brain. The brain is such a complex organ, and we see that in lots of different areas. And concussion is just a great example. We know that we need to protect it more. We know that we've got to let these people that get concussions, we know we need to let them recover before they get back out and play again. But we still don't understand when are too many concussions too many. Is one that a brain should ever sustain? How old, when we start seeing concussions in kids, you know, how old can they be? We start seeing concussions in younger kids, the more active that they are. We know the young child's brain is developmentally different from the old child's brain, from the, you know, high schooler's brain, from the college brain, and from the adult brain. So those are all challenges that we continue to see. Fortunately, we are really looking at protecting the athlete more, I think, than we ever have in the realm of concussion. Now there's laws that have been passed across the country. We have a law here in the state of Oklahoma for high school athletes. If you have an athlete that is even suspected of having a concussion, they're taken out of the whatever they're in, and they cannot go back to play until they've been cleared by a healthcare provider who's knowledgeable in treating concussions.
I had an experience earlier this summer. I was volunteering at a summer camp where there was a track meet and a kid slipped and hit his head, and I was blessed to have an athletic trainer who was very well qualified at my side. And I went and sort of did the old once-over, looked at the kid, said, you know, how many fingers am I holding up? And, you know, he seemed fine to me. But the trainer proceeded to whip out this 5-page concussion checklist. And I was like, wow, I mean, this has really gotten scientific. And he felt very obligated in order to assure that kid could continue to participate. And I was both humbled and impressed at that.
Yeah, and it's critical. Athletic trainers play a critical role in taking care of kids, especially in organized sports. And the training that they get in the area of concussions is better than most healthcare providers out there. And so it's very, very important that we do a comprehensive look at individuals in diagnosing the concussion, but also in getting them back to play. It's not simply a matter of, hey, okay, all your symptoms are gone, go back in and play. We have a graduated return to play protocol that we used, which allows them to do increasingly harder both cognitive work and physical work, and to assure that they don't have any return of their symptoms before we allow them to get back to play.
I want to shift gears for a second and ask you, you had mentioned earlier about your time in the military, and I know now you're a lieutenant colonel in the Oklahoma Air National Guard, and where you are also chief of aerospace medicine here in Tulsa. And how does your military experience inform your medical practice and vice versa?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have always been assigned to fighter squadrons, and I'm in a fighter squadron here in Tulsa also. They are very, very similar. Sports medicine and aerospace medicine are very, very similar because you have a group of people, especially fighter pilots, who are very highly motivated to keep doing what they're doing. It's their livelihoods, what they love. And so these guys always want to get back and get better and keep going, which is a nice thing to deal with. Sometimes it's challenging because they don't want you to know anything that's going on with them because they don't want any chance that they would not get to fly. But, you know, it's good because they're highly motivated. They're very type A for the most part, and they do their job and they do it really well. And they're like athletes. They're just a different type of an athlete, and it's fun because they get very, very focused at what they do, just like athletes do. They rehearse these things in their minds all the time, just like what athletes do, and they really strive to perform at the peak of their level, just like what athletes are doing.
What are the physical fitness requirements for the Oklahoma Air National Guard?
Well, they really come down from the branches of the service, Air Force, Army, Marines, so those same physical fitness standards have to be met by the Guard. And we do our physical fitness assessment, which is push-ups and sit-ups, and we do a run and that type of stuff to just make sure that people are fit enough to be able to deploy. We also encourage people as they're, day-to-day, we may test them once a year or twice a year, but they have to know that they're responsible for, on a daily and weekly basis, maintaining their fitness level, because they can be called up at any time. They got to be ready to go.
You were deployed once, I think, to Iraq.
Yes.
Right? What was that like?
It was very dry, very dusty. We were in an area of Iraq right in the middle in a base called Al-Asad, and there was absolutely nothing around there, which is very interesting. We were there at an interesting time, too, because we were really moving all of the troops out of Iraq, and it was right at the end of that conflict. We were there, sent short notice to provide air cover support for all these troops driving convoys out of Iraq to get all of our men and women and equipment out of there. And so it was interesting because while we were there, they gradually were reducing and smaller and reducing services that were there. So it was interesting to see how this large air base that we'd been operating for many years there got shrunk down to really nobody left.
Does the air base still operate, or was it totally taken apart?
It still operates. It was an Iraqi base before we took it over, and then we did all our stuff with it, and then we handed it back over to the Iraqis.
I want to circle back to running. I guess, what advice would you give a patient who has never been a runner, but let's say in their 40s or 50s, who says, you know what, I only have an hour a day to myself, where I don't have work or community groups or kids around, and I really want to, you know, I guess I'm going to start walking, but I've maybe been walking for a while, and now I want to up the ante and do some running or even compete in one of these competitive races. You know, so what advice would you give, and what kind of regimen would you recommend?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's very important that they see their physician. Before they're going to start doing any type of exercise program, especially when you get into your 40s, 50s, or 60s, it's really important. And if you haven't had somebody that's just looking at you every year, getting an annual checkup, doing those types of things, looking at all the preventative health issues, that's an important thing to do. Once we kind of do that and they say, yep, we think you're safe to be starting a program, I think you start something nice and easy. And I love the concept. You know, Jeff Galloway, I think, was one of the guys that really came up with this idea of running and walking combined. And there's a lot of different iterations of that. But, you know, for a lot of folks, they can start out, you can walk a minute and run a minute and jog a minute. Walk a minute, jog a minute. And then you may walk a minute, you may jog 2 minutes, or walk a minute, jog two, three. Some people will do it kind of by mileage. They may jog a mile and then walk a minute. But I think the combination of those two things, walking and jogging, I think are great for the person that's starting out. And the key thing is to, you know, start slow. You know, this is a lifelong journey that we're trying to create. And so you don't have to start it by sprinting that first day. So start out with something that you feel comfortable with doing. You don't want to feel miserable when you're doing this. Save that for later. Once you kind of get in and you know you're doing it and you're exercising pretty consistently and you're like, all right, now I'm ready to start upping my game a little bit. I want to run a little bit faster. I want to run that full 5K, or I want to run that half marathon. What do I need to do to take it to that level? That's when you can start really pushing yourself more and challenging yourself more and building some of those other creative plans to get you there faster.
Well, Monty Cavan, I want to thank you so much for coming down to Studio Tulsa. I've learned a lot today, and I think I'm learning about your practice and those tools particularly is very, very interesting.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
Monty Cavanaugh is a sports medicine physician and the chief of sports medicine at the OU School of Community Medicine here in Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa on Health for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Opinions expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our recent broadcasts, you can stream them anytime by going to our website at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.